Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight, as I mentioned, is with two wonderful people, Kemmerie Wilcher, Executive Director, Carpe Diem West, and Fernanda Santos, journalist of the New York Times and the rest, and has in, is in the Western Writers of America, has won the Western Writers of America 2017 award. And it's my pleasure to introduce you to them, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. Good evening, everyone. Yes, we're going to be talking about climate chaos, and we're going to be talking about fire and water. And I know we're all a little reeling from that, thinking about the last 6 months in California and what we've seen with the terrible fires and then with these catastrophic mud floods, as we're calling them, that come afterwards. Fernanda is fire tonight, and I am water, and we're going to be talking about how those two meet in the American West, in the time of climate change. And we're not talking about just any wildfire, of course. We're talking about catastrophic, uncontrollable wildfire. And we're not talking about just any rain events. We're talking about extreme weather events where all of a sudden the skies just open up at times of the year when they shouldn't open up, or when it's so hot, like outside, and it shouldn't be at this time of the year. So what we're not going to do talk much about at all this evening is climate change itself. I know that all of us in this room could start rattling off the things that scare them the most about climate change. So let's not focus on climate change itself per se. Our focus is going to be on what some amazing communities and amazing community leaders are doing across the American West right now to make their communities as resilient as possible to whatever climate change in the form of uncontrollable wildfire or huge rain events are sending their way. So we're going to talk about fire and water. We're also going to talk about our national forests. And in the American West, about 60% of our water, that's the source of it, is in these national forests. And we know that these national forests have been burning. We know that decades of mismanagement have not let them in the best of shape, to say the least, that those fires are essential for us to have any hope of getting through this time of climate change to what we hope will be a better place. So let's start with fire. Fernanda.
Well, first of all, thanks everybody for being here tonight, and thanks for inviting me to join you, Kemmerie. So in 2013, I was a bureau chief for the Southwest in Arizona, based in Arizona for the New York Times, and there was a large fire burning near the little town of Yarnell. It's about, as the crow flies, about 70 miles northwest of Phoenix, and this fire started like many other fires in the West start in the monsoon season. There was a lightning strike into the dried brush and at the top of a mountain, and it burned for 2 days without much concern. Until finally on Sunday, June 30th, 2013, the day that many firefighters were sent to that fire. Among these firefighters were the members of the hotshot crew known as the Granite Mountain Hotshots. There was a monsoon storm that came and essentially hooked the flames, turned them 180 degrees, and they came back where they had already burned. They went back to a place they had already burned and went straight toward the town of Yarnell. At that time, the town of Yarnell had not seen fire in about 40 years. The fire was burning on the west side of town, choked with heavy, thick brush, like we see a lot here in California, especially in Southern California. The type of brush that makes just fuels these fires in such a way that it's virtually impossible, if not completely impossible, for crews of firefighters who work with essentially landscaping tools to stop these the flames from burning. And this crew made a decision. We were talking earlier. I said it's a risk management job. You weigh the options very quickly based on the information you have, based on the information you're given, including weather reports, and you decide what to do. And in this case, they decided to go up from the top of a mountain where the fire had already burned, presumably a safe place or the safest place in the case of wildfires, the black as it's known, and went down into a canyon, which anybody who knows anything about fires know you never go down into a canyon when a fire is burning because flames go up and go up very quickly. And they were trying to make it to the town to help that town as the fire was threatening it. And they were overcome by the fire. And 19 of the members, all of them died. One was the lookout. He was already separated from the crew and he was the only survivor. So I wrote the story of this fire, covered the fire for the Times. I wrote a book about it. So obviously there was a lot of criticism afterwards, right? How do you let this brush grow so thick? How did the community allow the brush to grow so thick around their homes? Why did they turn away crews, inmate crews that were hired with grants to go and clear up the brush around their houses? Mm. A lot of people said they wanted to remain, to keep their privacy, that the brush allowed them to be in privacy. Mm. And they didn't want that cut down. Mm. So when their houses burned, they got very upset. But you know, there was this over 100 structures destroyed in a town where the minimum median income is about $30,000. So it's not a wealthy town. A lot of people didn't have insurance. It was very significant, affected the tax base, all sorts of things, right? So fast forward to 2016. On the east side of Yarnell, almost the same date, another lightning strike started a fire there. And this fire starts burning. And of course, the first thing that everybody thinks is it's going to burn the other side of town, the side of town that wasn't burned 3 years earlier. Except that there was one thing that happened in between. And it's one of those cases where the lessons are learned in the hardest possible ways, right? The fire chief said, we are going to get as much money as we can in terms of grants. And we're going to create a barrier between the east side of town and the brush that's there and that it's as thick as it was on the west side. But we're going to carve a defensible space. We're going to carve a buffer zone so that if there is a fire there, the fire will sort of peter out and not be fueled by the homes and then keep burning because the homes all of a sudden become fuel for the fire, right? So that's what happened. The firefighters had that space, that comfortable zone to fight, to work on that fire. They were able to corral the fire before it hit the town. Mm-hmm. And no houses burned on the east side of Yarnell. And after this fire happened, I wrote a story about the lessons learned, and I started to think about how many times we wait for government, right, to do things for us. We wait for big government, for the federal government to clear our forests. Of course, the federal government has huge responsibility over a lot of land in the West. But a lot of times in our communities, we can also play a role in protecting ourselves. We can also get the grants, get the prison crews, get the defensible space carved out around our own properties. Mm-hmm. Understand also the risk if you're going to live so close to the wilderness that your house may well burn. And the decision becomes, do you put more men on the line, more women on the line and risk their lives to save your home? Or do you accept that at some point we can't stop these fires and your house may burn, but let's save your life, you know? So this is my fire story. It sort of like opened my eyes to how in even what may seem like small ways we can change things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, the Yarnell story is such one of tragedy and one of enormous hope because, as you said, this community went ahead and took care of it. So All right, I'm going to talk a little bit about water and fire and forests. How many of you are familiar with the geography of New Mexico? Ah, quite a few of you. Well, in a nutshell, the Rio Grande runs sort of north to south on the west side of the state. There are mountains that are on either side of it, probably, I don't know, almost to Albuquerque, something like that. And out of those mountains, the Jemez or the Sangre de Cristos, comes the water. That joins the river and feeds into the river. And this water supports the farming communities of the pueblos up and down the river. It's the drinking water and using it for whatever water for Albuquerque, for Santa Fe, for Los Alamos, for other communities up and down the river. It, for those of you who like to eat beef, it grows a lot of alfalfa in the middle Rio Grande through the conservancy district there. It's an essential river. And for those of you who also know New Mexico, know that New Mexico has the least amount of surface water of any state in the country. And most of its surface water is brackish, so it's not necessarily usable. So again, it's an essential river. In 2011, that must have been a big fire year, I'm thinking.
It was a big fire year, yes.
It was, yeah.
And especially for New Mexico.
And especially for New Mexico, exactly. The Los Conchas fire started burning in the Jemez Mountains, and it burned and burned and burned, and I don't know, it almost took out Los Alamos, and it almost took out this, and it almost took out that, and it was a horrible fire, and it was huge. And then after they sort of got the fire out, this being the Southwest, the rains came, the monsoons came, and those monsoons unleashed this torrent of mud. And again, we're talking about mud floods.
The one we just saw here in California.
The ones we saw here in Southern California. And those mud floods just flowed downhill. They took out farmland for the pueblos. They took out a world famous apple orchard. And then they went roaring into the middle stretch of the Rio Grande. And the Rio Grande ran black for days. Albuquerque had to shut off its water intake into the Rio Grande because the river was black. And so I think did Santa Fe and other communities. By some miracle, nobody was killed, which was just that was fairly miraculous. So fast forward a couple of years, and so here you have forests in the Southwest, kind of like forests in California, very dry, very prone to fire. And these fires are causing this, these huge impacts on the water sources for most of the population of New Mexico. So a group started talking, and a group of local citizens, of business people, of folks from the Pueblo, from the Forest Service, from environmental groups, from local government, and they said, we've got to do something about these fires. They're just going to continue. The water is our lifeblood. This is what we need in New Mexico. So they started an organization called the Rio Grande Water Fund. And that fund, since it was started a couple of years ago, has raised a couple of million dollars. They're working in partnership with the Forest Service, with state forestry, with local landowners to go in and restore the forests. And one of the things that I like so much about this Rio Grande Water Fund is they're also creating local jobs. People doing doing work in the woods. The New Mexico timber industry, forest products industry, is trying to bring that industry back with some value-added forest products. So again, this is the type of the type of things that communities are doing across the West. As Fernanda said, we're not waiting for the government to come, the federal government to come along and save us, even though, again, New Mexico has, especially on the West side, most of the land outside of the nation, the Navajo Nation, is owned by the federal government. We're not waiting for the federal government. They had a good Forest Regional Director, Forest Service Regional Director to work with. That went really well. So, and they're getting out there and they are doing the restoration. Some of you may know, just as a side note, I just always love this quote, from the folks that, passed a $10 million bond measure, in Flagstaff, Arizona, mm-hmm. a couple of years ago, because again, the fires came. The water was hit with mudslides and mud floods, and they were able to convince the bonding agencies. They said, look, our water infrastructure is in this forest. So they went ahead and did it themselves. And as, we asked the local wildland fire supervisor for the city. I said, "So, like, what's one of your biggest lessons, takeaways, Paul, from this?" And he said, "Don't wait for the feds to come along and save you." So they went ahead and did it themselves. And again, it's not like it's not in partnership with the Forest Service, with the Bureau of Land Management, with the federal agencies that manage these lands. So. You know, so I think some of the things that you're going to hear, you know, as we go through these stories, you know, they're part of the report that we just did at Carpe Diem West. And you can find it on our website. And at the end of the presentation tonight, we'll put the slide up there that you can, pull it down online, because that's what everyone does these days. You don't actually publish anything. You publish it online. You know, you're going to find this evening that sort of three themes are running through, these stories that Fernanda and I are talking about. One is smart partnerships, and I would say diverse partnerships, too. And certainly in the case of the Rio Grande Water Fund and in other folks around the West, they have to be diverse partnerships because people bring different resources, different ideas, different perspectives, different constituencies mm-hmm. to the table. So it's not, you know, a collaboration. It's one thing I love about federal agencies. They always talk about, well, we're collaborating. We're collaborating with Fish and Wildlife, and we're collaborating with the Bureau of Land Management, and we're collaborating with NOAA. It's like, uh-huh. So that's one thing. So smart partnerships that are an inclusive, larger tent. Probably the second thing is the multi-benefit solutions that you get from restoring forests, protecting water supply, protecting the natural water supply that we all rely on in the West. And, you know, that's about jobs. It's about climate resiliency, obviously. And it's also about our health. I don't know how many of you got to inhale a lot of smoke this summer. Yeah, and you can think of the folks that were up in the Pacific Northwest, especially in the Seattle area. They inhaled even more smoke. The folks in California's Central Valley are inhaling smoke all the time. So it is about it is also about our health. And then the third thing, which Fernanda's going to talk a little bit about next, is the fair sharing of water. And it's sharing of water for people, for the rivers, and for the food that we eat, the food that is grown here in the West. And there's not a lot of fair sharing of water going around right now in the American West. Some places, yes, but most places, not so much.
Yeah, and a great example of that is the lower Colorado River area in Yuma, Arizona. That's where 90% of the leafy greens that we consume in the entire United States in the winter is produced. So you, if you're driving there from Phoenix, as I have done many times, the Sonoran Desert is kind of lush. It has a lot of green to it, but then there comes a point in this along this drive that the desert becomes like a desert. There's not any life to it. It's kind of sandy and just not attractive. And then all of a sudden, like there is an apparition in front of you, the desert becomes green, just bright, lush, beautiful green. And the first time I saw it, it almost took my breath away because it was just not what I expected. And I thought, the miracle of water. Yeah. This is irrigation, right? It's creating all this lettuce, broccoli, kale, it's all grown there, spinach. So my understanding of that region was always from the perspective of the farming and the water that allows for us to grow all these plants there, all these greens there. Sometime last year, I started hearing about the work that some Hispanic evangelical pastors were doing in the area. I know it's obviously right on the border, very heavily Hispanic Latino area, huge influence of Mexico there. It's sort of one of those places where you know, if it weren't for the border, you wouldn't know where you were sometimes. Mm-hmm. If in Mexico or the United States, and these pastors were working to educate their community, their congregations, about the importance of preserving the river, but from a very different perspective, which is not entirely new, because some white evangelical Christians, there is a strain of them that has been talking about preserving the planet because it's God's creation. But here we had Hispanic evangelical pastors speaking to a constituency that uses that river as their source of fun. It's the place they take their kids. It's free. The river is there. Mm-hmm. Yet they are noticing year after year the river is shallower. It's getting dirtier. It's just looking unhealthy. You know, there are bodies of water that sometimes maybe some of us remember from our youth that you go years later and you go, this just doesn't look healthy at all. And that's sort of the feeling you have sometimes when you go to parts of the Colorado River in Yuma near Mexico. And so these pastors started talking to people, you know, who are people who suffer from unemployment. They suffer from issues with drugs. The cartels recruit a lot of the young American citizens in these towns to cross drugs. So these are parents that are very worried about their kids. So they have big, big, you know, existential questions to grapple with and that are they hear about at sermon. And these pastors started introducing the idea of caring for the river. This is part of your life. This is what supports your jobs. They work on these fields. So they depend on water supply to water these fields so that they can eat. They also eat as in have work so they can buy their food, right? Because a lot of times they don't eat the healthy food that is produced for the rest of the country. It's also a place that is their home. It's the place where they take their kids on weekends. And so they started having these Sunday outings after service to go in and clean up the riverbed. If they have a church picnic, they take the trash away and they pick other trash too. Mm-hmm. And they started talking about how if you go and take a shower, don't leave the shower on, turn it off to preserve water. It might seem so minuscule because these are, you know, some half dozen, a dozen evangelical, Hispanic evangelical churches in that area, except that the effort was sort of replicated along the lower Colorado River stream. Churches in Denver were doing the same. Churches in the Rockies were doing the same. And all of a sudden, you have this critical mass of people who are then educating their children, mm-hmm. who then go to school and talk to their classmates, who then become little ambassadors, and you start changing. And I remember coming back from that trip almost transformed in a way of like, you know, how interesting that a group of people, you know, who I never would have associated with climate protection or, you know, environmentalism, mm-hmm. all of a sudden became these great ambassadors, all grounded on their religious belief that this is planet Earth is what God made for us, and we have the responsibility to care for it. And, it was great.
Excuse me, Senator Fernandez. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Climate Chaos and Local Resilience, Water Solutions in the American West. And we've heard a lot already, and it's been really fascinating. So we want to remind you on our radio and in our audience that our speakers tonight are Kemmeri Wiltshire, Executive Director, Carpe Diem West, Fernanda Santos, journalist from the New York Times, and the Western Writers of America 2017 Award. So now it's back to Kemmeri and Fernanda to share with us more of their experiences.
Keep going.
Well, you know, I wonder what you have to tell me, Kemmeri, because I wrote the introduction to this report that Kemmeri mentioned. Mm-hmm. I don't usually do stuff like that because I always get worried about being sounding too partisan or too this, too that. Uh-huh. And I did a lot of checking before. But when I was reading through the stories that you had in the report, mm-hmm. I said, you know, there's no way that I can be seen as biased here because you have governmental agencies, mm-hmm. You have environmental groups, you have mm-hmm. pastors in Yuma, you know, because right. it was one of the stories yes. featured was that. And I said, you know, it's just the common thread was the idea that, you know, take ownership. It's our water. Mm-hmm. We can do things to make it better, to preserve it, to fight for it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I come from the pastors, but you have other stories to tell as well.
Well, and, you know, I was just thinking, you know, when we saw Fernanda's story in the New York Times in 2017, about what was happening in the Colorado River. And we've done a lot of work. Our organization has done a lot of work on the Colorado River. But this was a whole new aspect to folks caring about the river. And doing something about it. As Fernanda was just saying, this may seem very minuscule, but I don't see a lot of churches in, or I don't hear about a lot of, like, white churches in Denver going out and saying, we're going to go and clean up the river. You know, this river is, you know, an important part of our family. We need to respect the river. And it was so exciting for us to read about it because those of you who even just have like a little inkling of what Western water politics and Western water policy is like know that the states are siloed, the different irrigation districts are siloed, the different water utilities are siloed. There's not very much cross-fertilization. There's no real constituency to say, hey. You farmers in the lower Colorado that are using 90% of the water, are you really sure you need quite that much water?
It's also so complicated, right?
It's so complicated trying to understand.
I remember I had a full day, a full afternoon briefing with three organizations yeah. to understand just how the water is apportioned because I had to understand that so yeah. that I could think of stories. And I said, wow, I need like a panel of people to explain to me. And yeah. I still had 1,000 questions after they talked.
I know. It is very confusing. Western water law is very confusing. And, you know, you sometimes it's like, how are we the people supposed to weigh in to our elected officials and go, hey, about that 90% use for, you know, growing alfalfa
right.
in the lower Colorado basin in the middle of the desert for alfalfa that's being shipped in more and more to Japan and China because they're interested in beef. How do we do that? So again, we are so privileged to have known, you know, these folks that are working on the river and on the water. So I'm going to take a little different part of the world and head north to Missoula, Montana. Anybody been there? Okay, Missoula is sort of like in this basin, and people say, oh yeah, well Missoula gets all of its water from groundwater. Actually, that groundwater is fed by the forests that are in the mountains around Missoula. So again, we come back to the forests and how much we depend on them. For a few decades now, maybe even longer, I'm trying to remember how long, Missoula's water has been owned by, water system has been owned and managed by a multinational corporation. And a while back, you know, some folks in Missoula said, you know, this makes us nervous. It makes us nervous for a couple of reasons. I mean, obviously, it's a multinational corporation.
And it's the water that we're drinking.
And it's the water that we're drinking. And we don't have any say in it, right?
Right.
You know, it's like we don't have any connection with them. You know, they would like to make their money and make their stock, their shareholders happy, and then do whatever they're going to do next. And the other, I think, thing that people realized is just a growing understanding of the essential role of these forests that surround Missoula, where the water comes from and then goes into the groundwater. And, you know, in an increasing understanding of how important the forests were and how in bad shape many of them were. Many of you have heard about the big fires in western Montana just this last summer. And so folks started saying, we need to take back the management and ownership of our water system from this multinational corporation. So this multinational corporation, because we need to invest in these forests and we need to invest in these watersheds, and we know that this corporation isn't going to do it because why should they? I mean, it's not what corporations do. So they did it. They went to court. They had to do, I don't know, all these different legal things. The corporation fought it like crazy. And then last year, it took $84 million, which is a rather large number for a community the size of Missoula, but they were able to buy back their entire water system from this multinational corporation. And it now gives them the opportunity to invest in their watersheds, invest in their forests, and deal with the fact that, yes, climate change is also hitting the great state of Montana. That, you know, we think, oh, it's got so much snow and, you know, and all of those things. And it's cold, right? It's cold. It's way up there. Well, that's not at all been the case for Montana, what they've experienced over the past decade and what the long-range predictions are saying as well. So that, again, was just a very encouraging story for us.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And a really necessary development, because if you think about how climate is changing, a couple of years ago, we had fires in Canada. So farther north than Montana in February, the dog sled race in Alaska, what is it called?
Iditarod.
Yes. Yeah. A couple of times has had to be moved farther north because the snow in the Fairbanks area wasn't thick enough to support it. There have been fires in Alaska, fires in northern Arizona, which is also covered in snow this time of the year. If we look at the Sierra Nevadas now, there's hardly any snow there, right? So we start to think about those things. That's where our water comes from. It's that snow that falls and melts over time because it's not super hot. So it melts slowly, feeds the groundwater sources. Then we have this balance, right? But all of a sudden, things are kind of out of whack. Some people might say, oh, it's cyclical and it will change. Maybe it will. But right now, we have to think that all the signs are pointing to this becoming increasingly a warmer place to live, this planet, right? And so that Missoula was able to do that is significant, because the more people who depend on that water have a say over how the water is managed and used, the better it is, right? I would rather my neighbor thinks about and me decides on the water than some multinational company that's looking to make money out of it. So
We really love the Missoula story. You know, the scrappy little university town.
it's beautiful
that
there.
It is absolutely beautiful there. So, I just maybe want to tell one more story here because, you know, it's sometimes really easy to bash farmers in the American West, and those of us who care a lot about water sometimes do more than our fair share of doing some bashing. And of course, you know, agriculture is a multi-sector, diverse, community of, big agribusiness and small organic farmers out in West Marin. But I want to talk a little bit about what they did in Eugene, Oregon. Eugene, anybody been there? Well, you know, the Mackenzie River, which is the sole source of drinking water for Eugene and the surrounding area, you know, it's like this world-class rafting, fishing, pristine water. They barely treat it. It's like the water that comes out of the Wasatch Mountains into the Salt Lake region. I mean, they barely treat it at all. But there's in the middle stretch of the Mackenzie, there's a lot of hazelnut growers, orchards. There's a lot of small timber operators. And, of course, there's more and more development because everybody wants to live by the river and look at the nice river flowing by. So the Eugene City Council said, well, you know, we got to do something about this a few years back. You know, they said, we've got to put some regulations on those farmers, and because they're putting a lot of pesticides and a lot of chemicals into the river. Made perfect sense, right? I mean, who wants to be drinking this pristine water out of the Mackenzie, which is loaded with, I don't know, all the god-awful stuff that apparently they put a lot of god-awful stuff on hazelnuts, which is probably TMI. It is for me because I happen to like hazelnuts. So they had a, city council hearing and everything, and they just got blown out of the water because there were farmers that, ringed City Hall, and, they were, four deep with their trucks and their flags and their everything else, and the city council went, okay, fine, I guess we're not going to do that. So they turned to the water agency that manages the water in Eugene and said, okay, you guys come up with a solution. You guys figure this out. So the water agency went back and thought a lot, and everybody had seen those, those farming pickup trucks going around and around City Hall when the city council meeting was happening. And they came up with a plan that is innovative, collaborative, addresses climate change, and keeps, let's put it this way. They started with this. They said, this farming that happens not too far outside of Eugene city limits, it's really important to our local economy. And this farmer's market that comes in every weekend is really important to our citizens. We don't want these orchards to go away. We want this this part of the agricultural community to thrive. So that's the place that they started from. Instead of, we are going to go and put regulations on you and you will obey. So they established their VIP program. What can I say? The Voluntary Incentives Program. And they started working with farmers up and down this middle stretch of the Mackenzie on a voluntary program where the farmers on a voluntary basis would switch their chemical use and their pesticide use to much less harmful modalities. And so this stuff was not going into the river. And this is paid for, so these farmers making this transition, and I'm not being a hazelnut grower, I can't tell you exactly what's involved. I know it has to do with the sex life and mating habits of this worm, this fly thing that goes in. So anyway, and you use a lot of chemicals to go and knock out this fly worm thing and mess up their sex drive and all of that. So they've been finding alternatives. They've been working with the university. And all of this is being paid for by the water agency because they said this is totally worth the price because we don't have to build another treatment plant. Mm-hmm. We have folks who are on the river who are our allies because we're helping them with their farming practices, and we want to see them succeed. So I think that's my last story. And we'll just end with the great city of Eugene, and I will turn it over to Ann.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Climate Chaos and Local Resilience, Water Solutions in the American West, with Kimmery Wiltshire, Executive Director, Carpe Diem West, and Fernanda Santos, journalist for the New York Times, and honored by the Western Writers of America with a 2017 award. Fortunately, we have come, would you believe it? It's time for our audience questions. And the first question veers a little bit away, I think, from what we've talked about yet. And the question is about the Puerto Rico hurricanes, talking about water. Mm. What is happening, in your opinion, in Puerto Rico? Or not happening.
Or not happening.
Not happening.
Poor, yeah, not happening. Those poor people. I mean, I can't keep track of the numbers of the number of people who are without potable water, but there are still hundreds of thousands?
Outside of San Juan.
Outside of San Juan.
There's mm-hmm. still people without water, without mm-hmm. electricity in some parts. And I think what it speaks to is mostly a complete collapse of the government there, which already was...
not in the best of shape.
Yeah, they had huge debt and yeah. didn't know how to pay for it. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of money there. Of course, it's a commonwealth of the United States. So in many ways, obviously, water is a huge issue, but they have so many problems, including repairing the entire infrastructure, which was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And you need a lot of money to do mm-hmm. that, right? So I don't know the specifics of the water, but I do know that... I teach at Arizona State University at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism, and we have a group of students that are going there now spring break. Oh. And the reason we decided to send them there to do some stories was exactly because we want to find out how things have changed, or have they changed at all since this hurricane hit outside of San Juan, which is the capital, and things kind of mm-hmm. got back into shape mm-hmm. more quickly.
Yeah.
Another question we have is, what local strategies can you suggest that can be effective to avoid having our water supplies depleted, like is being experienced and projected for South America? How do we motivate and organize people before their house burns down and their water is gone?
Woo!
That's a
big question. We'll be here till midnight. I think the questioner is referring to Cape Town, South Africa, which they're down to what three months of water, and they're coming up on 0 day. And one of the number of fascinating things that I find about Cape Town is that this is a pretty environmentally aware mm-hmm. town, and their per capita water use is significantly lower, say, than that of Phoenix's or Las Vegas's or Portland, Oregon's, or actually Marin County's per capita. So it's not like these folks are, you know, water guzzlers that are using up all the water. So I think it's such a great question that the questioner asked, because this is what we struggle with. No, that's not right. This is what we are lucky enough to be dealing with at our work at Carpe Diem West, is bringing together folks from different backgrounds and different ideas and different representing different constituencies who bring different perspectives to the table and ideas and resources. And I think that it's not going to be a technological fix, even though technology is great and can help. All farmers should have some form of you know, irrigation efficiency, when you see that, you know, farmers in the American West use about 80% of the water, give or take. So I think we need to be on our elected officials, and you probably all need to get elected to your local water board.
And I have something that I've been thinking about. I have an 8-year-old, and her school in the third grade, they have a service focused thing, and they are talking about protecting planet Earth. It's the green team. She's a member of the green team. And I think it's so interesting when I see the things that she talks about. So I have somebody who helps me, picks her up in school a couple of days a week, brings her home because I teach until late and so forth. Everybody who was a working parent understands what I'm talking about. And this woman was telling me the other day, she said she thought it was so funny that she was washing the dishes and the water was running, and my daughter said, "You should turn off the water because you shouldn't waste all this water." So it got me thinking about how really one of the best things we can do is get our schools to teach our kids early on about the need to conserve water, mm-hmm. compost at home. If you live in a city that has a recycling program, "Mom, are we recycling our paper, our cardboard? Mm-hmm. You know, why don't we recycle the shopping bags? Maybe the city, is there a way that we can get," because there are programs mm-hmm. in San Francisco has one of those.
Yeah, very good.
Phoenix does not. So we recycle the newspaper, the cardboard, mm-hmm. but not the plastic bags. And then the legislature and the state punishes cities that try to ban plastic bags. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to understand the rationale. But anyway, it just really got me thinking mm-hmm. about how that's a great thing that we can all do as parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts. So what are you talking about in the school about conserving the planet? Are you teaching the kids about recycling? It's not about climate change. It's not a Republican, Democrat, liberal, progressive thing. It's conservative. It's just recycling, using what's already available and expanding, using the resources that are already there. Mm-hmm. Of course, our babysitter shut off the water after my daughter said that. And she stays on top of things. She hikes with me and she picks up trash and puts in her backpack. And it just becomes a natural thing to her. And I said, how much kids can teach us, right? Yeah. So if only we teach them first, right? So, yeah, that's my little contribution to that.
The next question is, given there are so many points of view about the, quote, right way, unquote, to manage our forests, could you bring us up to date on what the latest science recommends, e.g. clear out dead trees or not?
Okay. 2 a.m.? We can stay here till 2 a.m. That works. That's good. You know, again, that's such an important question. So let me say, first of all, it depends, because it depends on what part of the American West you're talking about. It depends on what the climate is, what the tree types are, what the soil is like. The problem with clearing out, so there is some science that says that clearing out dead trees, like in Southern California, is great. And there's some science that says clearing out dead trees doesn't do a darn thing. There's not an increase in wildfire. One of the things that we can look to is what we saw with the bark beetles in Colorado. And those of you who have been to Colorado, I mean, not just on the west slope of Colorado, but also on the Front Range with Denver and Colorado Springs and Boulder, you know, you just see these, they're sort of remarkable looking, these dead trees that have been eaten by bark beetles because, you know, the climate's not getting cold enough for them to all croak in the winter the way they're supposed to. And so there was this, even like 5 or 6 years ago, there was this huge concern that there were going to be these conflagrations of immense size on both the Front Range and the West Slope because these trees were dead and so they were all going to burn. And watersheds were going to be affected. And what's fascinating is they haven't. And the scientists are all kind of scratching their heads going, well, we're not entirely sure. But what we thought was going to happen hasn't happened. So It depends, and I think it's important that people get to know and the forests that they love and care about, and figure it out for themselves.
But if I can add, trees, firefighters call vegetation fuel. Right. Because that's what it is. It's how fires burn. They burn. They feed on the stuff that's there. The drier it is, mm-hmm. the more fuel that fire has to burn. So California, Southern California especially, there was a huge problem with the dead trees there. Mm-hmm. Killed by bark beetle. It's different when timber industry comes and strategically cuts down trees. Mm-hmm. There are criticisms to be made of the industry, but there is, you know, they cut it down, they take it away. Mm-hmm. They do leave some scraps behind, which becomes an issue too when fire comes. But when you have entire trees and hundreds, thousands of trees falling and just staying there, it may well be that catastrophic fire hasn't happened, but should there ever be a fire there, rest assured that nobody will be able to get in.
Yeah.
And whatever is in the way of that fire mm-hmm. will burn. And we have to start thinking about, I don't know if you are familiar with the term wildland urban interface. So a lot of people mm-hmm. who live on the interface, they have their homes that are close, but a wild area. A wildland area. So there are certain regulations in terms of the materials for construction, the defensible space that you have to build around your house and so forth. But if you start to think about how development, the urban development is encroaching onto this, UWI, as they call it, the wildland urban interface, the rural development, then we have all one thing. And if the fire comes from the forest and starts burning these homes that are on the edge of forests and feeding on now onto these homes and the wind's blowing and the embers are traveling and now the embers are burning the houses farther away from the forest. And next thing you know, they are starting on the edges of these urban communities. Think of Santa Rosa. Santa Rosa is not a wildland urban interface area, yet it had a fire that was hugely destructive some months ago. So we have to start thinking about, you know, how it starts from the dead trees in the forest, but it may well connect to our home, you know, miles and miles and miles away.
Yeah.
So there is what the scientists say that is sort of like, why haven't these huge fires happened? But it is, I think, a fact that should a fire ever happen in these areas, nobody will be able to stop it. So then how far is that fire going to burn, you know?
Yeah.
Another question is, how have you used the many fire, water, climate linkages to leverage critical rethinking among groups of climate change skeptics?
That's for you.
You know, my feeling towards climate change skeptics, well, first of all, let me say one of the things that we have found about water in the American West is that it is not a blue issue and it's not a red issue. It is a purple issue, purple through and through. My feeling towards climate skeptics is I sort of take the same policy that the Los Angeles Times took about a year or two ago when they said, we're no longer printing letters to the editor from climate skeptics. Why? And so that's my policy.
How big is the need for restoration? How much will it cost, and how can we pay for it?
Wow.
Oh, wow. Okay, 3 a.m.
But let's try to get a...
Well, we just had big tax cuts, right? So
I don't think so.
Maybe it will rain money?
Maybe it'll rain. So I'll just give you one example of Northern Arizona. There, in Northern Arizona, there are 20 million acres that need restoration across four national forests. Those of you who have been in Northern Arizona can understand why that is the case. On average, it costs about $600 to $1,000 per acre to restore an acre of forested land. So you can go ahead and do the math. I'm not very good at when you start getting into like lots and lots of decimal points. What $1,000 times 2 million acres would look like. And that's just in Northern Arizona. I mean, you know, you think of all the other places in the West. We need a complete rethinking of how we finance this work. We have water agencies downstream, whether it be the water agency in Phoenix or Aurora, Colorado, or Salem, Oregon, or Salt Lake City or Albuquerque, which is investing in, in restoration work for these forests. But it's not a couple of billion dollars. You know, it's really small money. We really need a complete different way of rethinking it. And if we start really honoring and acknowledging the role, you know, this water is essential to our life, that comes out of these forests, then that can start to shift thinking. I also think this is just my pipe dream. A few decades back, we had something called the WPA, and the WPA, I can't remember the numbers, but they put an enormous number of work to people to work. The Work Project Administration by the Roosevelt administration, and amazing things got done and amazing things got built. We need that kind of federal focus also on these forests.
That's when we started having a professional, so to speak, a crew of firefighters that we started treating. You know, a lot of these firefighters,
really,
the fire crews came out of the CCCs.
The conservation corps.
Conservation camps. Camps. The crews that they had started that sort of like gave rise to a lot of these more, established and fire crews and hierarchy of fire crews that we have today. It came from that, because a lot of the work they did was to treat the forest, but in that they learned how to fight fires, because in case they were there and a fire started, they had to know what to do. Right. So, And it gave a lot of jobs to a lot of people.
Yes, it did.
Another question is, I've heard that in order to take down a fire burnt tree or a beetle invested tree costs $1,000 per tree. And that also affects homeowners who live in those areas, as well as the government land that is also suffering under this. Can you comment on that? So $1,000 to take down the tree damage. The tree that is damaged.
It probably depends on the home site and depends on, if it's private land, depends on the home site, how steep is the slope, how ready of access does do the tree cutters have to it. It's expensive. You know, you think of all these pine trees in Marin County that were, they were planted whenever they were planted because they grew fast. Well, not only do they buckle sidewalks, that's the least of it. I mean, they're just little torches. And to take each one of those down, it's expensive.
But we do California has a huge inmate
population.
Firefighting, a large number of fire crews that are prison fire crews, that not only do they fight the fires that happen in California, but they also can be hired to do that kind of work. In Arizona is the same thing, much smaller program. The state of Arizona is just now experimenting for the first time. It's still only one crew that's of its 20 members, 18 are former inmates who were trained in prison to be firefighters. And when they were released, they were hired by the state for a full-time job that during the fire season will be a firefighting role that they'll play. And in the off season, if we can even call it that way these days, they will do the type of conservation work that in the forest. And the idea is twofold. One, it starts to kind of creatively think of a way to solve this big problem that Arizona and other states in the West have, but in this case, Arizona has. And at the same time, It gives these inmates who have a highly employable skill, but many times have a hard time finding a full-time job because of their criminal record, a chance at getting a full-time job, and doing the work that they, that we all taxpayers paid them to learn how to do while they were in prison. So, it's brand new. It's just starting. But it's a very interesting way of thinking about it. You know, it's obviously not necessarily related to that question, but that's what some of them do. They go and they cut down these trees and they chop down the logs and then they haul it all away at the cost of paying our taxes, you know.
Unfortunately, we have reached that point in our program for our last question. What type of projects can protect snowpack from ash deposits? And of course, we do have snow in the Sierras, right? Ash deposits, and who would fund that?
Well, let me take a relatively easy one. There's a huge project that's run by NASA and out of University of Colorado at Boulder, looking at dust on snow, because what they're finding, especially on the Front Range of the Rockies, and the Rockies really are the water towers of the American West, is that this dust comes over from the west and deposits on the snow. So of course it's dark, so it melts a lot faster. Well, where is that dust coming from? That dust is coming off primarily public lands in Arizona, Utah, Nevada, that are being disturbed by cattle grazing, oil and gas, development. So it's a little wacko when you think that the west slope of Colorado is almost all national forest land, that over 85% of the water in the main stem of the Colorado River comes from these national forest lands, and the dust that's lowering the amount of snowpack in the Rockies is coming from federal lands in other states. So I would just like it if, like, the federal land guys, and they're mostly guys, could sit down and figure this out.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Climate Chaos and Local Resilience, Water Solution in the American West, with Kimmeri Wilcher, Executive Director, Carpe Diem West, and Fernanda Santos, journalist with the New York Times, and an award winner of the Western Writers of America in 2017. Many thanks to Kimmeri Wilcher, Executive Director, and our guest, and our second guest, who's been wonderful also, Fernanda Santos. Let's give them a big hand of applause.
Thank you.
And many, many thanks to our terrific audience here with terrific questions and on the radio and the internet. So let's everyone give themselves an applause for the wonderful work that they talked about. You can find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org also for multimedia access and listening to our various programs. If you look on our website, look for Watch and Listen to find program news, radio schedules, audio and video tapes. And for us in the environmental community, look for our spring upcoming environmental programs. February 15th, Thursday, Why Protect Half the Planet and Where to Start. Thursday, March 15th, Kenyan Youth Innovation Centers, Solar Energy Projects. This is working in Kenya with youth who are developing these programs. Monday, April 30th, the Spring 2018 Report on the Sierra Nevada's Rain, Fires, Drought, Snowpack, Trees, Water, and Ecosystems. This is our annual report that we do each year in the spring. Wednesday, May 9th, Use Solar, Solar Simplified, Power Amplified, and looks at the systems that might be developed in Puerto Rico. And then Wednesday, May 23rd, Sonic Sea Documentary. That Sonic Sea documentary is a wonderful one. It has just glorious documentary sound and projects and things that are doing, which are looking at what's happening to our Sonic Sea and the damage that is done and what we can do to help it. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us tonight. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.